Peter. I really enjoyed your talk yesterday evening. Thank you for that. And like we mentioned yesterday, that I guess I'm in my early 60s. You're kind of like in your late 60s, maybe. So you know your formative years were prior to the internet, and so in those days, like maybe you know we could start maybe in your late teens or something, but the calling or how your interest in seeking or searching began.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, at school I achieved the undesirable fame at our school of getting the prize in religious studies. Now, my mother had been a Mercy nun. She was taken in at Grafton, converted at the age of 12, then entered the convent in Grafton at the age of 15.
Oh, wow.
And she'd had an experience when she entered a Catholic church. Her cousin was a Catholic. She entered the Catholic Church as a child and had this experience in there. So she entered, the nuns got hold of her, I shouldn't say that got hold of her, but they encouraged her and to enter at 15. So from 15 till the age of 30, she was a Catholic Mercy nun, and she saw a huge amount of life. She nursed an old nun to her death at about age 15 or 16 when she entered.
Wow.
So she saw some immediate, very powerful things, and she, most people said she was a very beautiful young girl, so she sacrificed all that part of her life that beautiful young people go through and experience. So,
I just closed the school. So.
So, age 30, she, in that era, it was like breaking out of a prison. She broke down the gates of the Vatican and arrived in Brisbane with a bundle of clothes she was given for civvy life and a shaved head or short hair.
And did she tell the story of why she
told it. Yeah. She never told it, no. She never revealed that to her in all her 99 years. She never revealed that reason. She did often talk about the unmerciful Sisters of Mercy, and the order was founded for the poor, sick and ignorant, but she didn't see any of that really operating with many of the practitioners, and she didn't see that. That was the founding sort of goal of the founder in Dublin, but she didn't notice that. So fortunately, she retained some of the freedom of mind of a convert. She wasn't a totally indoctrinated Catholic. She just had this big experience, and that sort of moved her into that. So,
Did she tell you about the experience she had?
Yeah, she was happy to talk about that. There was an exposition of the Blessed Sacrament. The tabernacle was open, and she just had a massive experience. And I've noted over the years, country people seem more easily able to be open to these experiences, whether it's in France or Spain, or it's often simple people in the country who aren't too highly educated or too heavily stressed. They just seem to have these experiences much more often. They're kind of like third world experiences, really. We hear, the Philippines is full of them, and South America, and so. So I'd had an interesting, my father's mother was almost a nun. She built the church in Enfield in Sydney. They were quite a Catholic family. And so we had a very strong religious upbringing. We lost a sister at the age of 6 months through cot death. I remember people weeping, sobbing very deeply around a bed and saying the rosary. And so there was always this sense of religion.
How old were you then when you lost your sister?
I think I was three. Yeah, I was three.
Hmm. So, do you have a memory of that?
Oh yeah, very powerful. Yeah, very powerful memory. The doctor's car, we had a dirt road then. The house where we were still living actually, but the road was dirt, and Dr. Boxall's car speeding down the road to get there, and she was already gone. And the mother, you know, in panic mode, sobbing, and she, mother never got over that really. So there was a deep sense, kind of right from the beginning, of impermanence and in terms of human life, very particularly so. My mother said after that she went to where my sister and I, who was 16 months younger, attending a birthday party up the road at the Mallows place. Mum came to pick us up and said we didn't have the old joy we had as being kids for some time. So we were both hit by that very powerful lightning right into the family, and that was a shocking thing. After that, my grandfather passed when I was 10. So continuing on that sense of father at 18, so that continued through. At school, we had a prison-like Christian Brothers school that someone said told me in Ireland, it was in Ireland they say the Christian Brothers is entering a prison camp. We're all male school, and I was very shy.
Where was that, in Lismore?
In the Shire, in Sutherland.
Sutherland Shire,
okay. We call it the Shire, sorry for being so arrogant. So that was an interesting kind of monastic kind of right through. It was like we entered pretty young. And like Gary Shedd said, he was in a state school, the artist, and I was painting, drawing from the age of 3 or 4. I was very drawn to the visual arts. And I think when I heard Gary Shedd being interviewed, he said, in the 50s, being at school, you know, he said, I was the class artist. He said, I was accused of having artistic tendencies. So it was paramount to being gay. Were you considered gay if you had any showed any sign? Because everyone else was into league. I was into football too, and whatever, and sport. I loved sport, but if you had those tendencies, you were automatically gay, you know. So you had to go through that 50s type of initiation in Australia, which was a pretty frontier place. Even Sydney was, you know. Having said that, our class produced some remarkable people. We produced a CEO of the OECD in Paris, and world expert on Boswell's diaries, Gordon Turnbull. There's just two of them, professor at Yale University. They came out of our class. So there's only two. We had numerous doctors and lawyers, and so it was an interesting. But the all-male school, I'm very glad I sent my daughter to a co-ed school. You were scarred, you know, you've been scarred for life, really, in some ways. It wasn't even really spiritual. It was just a crowd control at its worst level, so.
And that was right to the your year 6, year 12?
Yeah, we entered at year 4.
Sorry?
We entered at grade 4, at fourth class, and I used to go back to the nuns for a year. I loved the nuns, and I used to go back and visit the convent near my house to say, please, can I come back? Can I come back to you people? You know, I'm missing you terribly, you know, because the brothers were shocking. You know, they were prison wardens, really. So it was a tradition. My father had gone to Christian Brothers. He was a scholarship boy at Thomas Keneally's old school, St. Pat Strathfield. So Dad took me over the day of starting. You know, he said, son, you've got to do it. You've got to leave the nuns and come to the brothers. It was a difficult thing. My friends went to another brother's school. I wanted to join them at least. But no, I had to go. He said, you had to go to this. So it was torturous, so torturous. So much so, I even wet my pants one day in class. I remember that. We're having a school reunion next year, so I hope no one brings that up. That was unbelievable.
Yeah, I could imagine how difficult that would have been for you as a boy. Yeah.
Shocking. So we had occasionally good teachers, you know, sprinkled around like, you know, like a speck of dust in a whole bar lounge room floor. There was the occasional good teacher that stood out, you know.
Yeah.
like the proverbial, yeah. And so we were saved sometimes. We were saved from...
If this had been a therapeutic conversation we were having, a bit, I'd be going more deeper into that. We won't do that today. It's another time.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, yeah, it was tough. And Dad was 10 years older than ten years younger than Mum, which was an interesting. I later discovered that so it was an interesting dynamic between my parents. A very loving dynamic, but a very powerful. Oh, you know, Mum was kind of like the the cougar, I guess, the modern. You know, she'd stolen the young male. You know, he'd been in the Second War, and he had his own drinking problem coming out of New Guinea. He lied about his age to get to New Guinea, and so there was an interesting... I think he mainly did that because my grandfather received a white feather in the First War, so Dad felt he had to get out. He was the youngest of seven, so...
Your grandfather received a...
A white feather for cowardice.
Really?
Women in the UK and Australia, particularly women, came round. And they were conditioned to think men who didn't go to war in the First War were cowards, so that white feather was placed in the letterbox.
Wow. I kind of heard of that, but I haven't really known much about it.
My grandfather was an incredibly good shot. He came off out of a farm at Braidwood. He would have gone for sure, but he had seven. He was right at the. He was in the middle of having seven kids.
Right.
And Archbishop Mannix in Melbourne said, "No, Billy Hughes, we're not having conscription. This is wrong, wrong, wrong." Because Mannix was Irish, and the Irish were opposing the war anyway. So, anyway, I'm an old English history teacher, so I don't want to go into that. But suffice it to say, I came out at 18 to ANU. My father had just died of a sudden heart attack at age 44. I took uni holidays. I had my teeth bashed in playing rugby league. I lost all my front teeth and an elbow in the mouth. I injured my back while I was surfing at Cronulla. I was a total. I ate at ANU for the first 6 months here. I was a write-off. So I ended up going to a school counsellor, uni counsellor, Margaret Evans, who was brilliant. I was bored my eyes out for about half an hour. And she said, "That's fantastic. Come back and see me next week."
This was the university counsellor at ANU.
Yeah, and she stayed for 20 or 30 years. I heard years
later. If you don't mind me asking, what year was that? That was
1970.
1970.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, anyway, ANU was like a cloister. I was at John's College. It was like a monastery there. Pretty well a continuation of the Christian Brothers.
Yeah.
His mum was so keen to get me in the Dominican Fathers.
Your parents would have paid for that, wouldn't they? Because it wasn't...
I had some sort of scholarship.
Okay.
It's like a Commonwealth scholarship.
Yeah, okay.
It was called a repat scholarship, but it was like a Commonwealth.
Right.
So, but Mum made great friends with Father Hegarty, who was a Dominican head of John's College, an old Irishman. He used to love to tipple a little bit on the side. He always smelt Father Hegarty's breath coming from about 500 metres. So, "Hello, Father," you know. So he was single-handed, with two or three others, trying to control these wild 1970 uni students at the height of the, height of the hippie revolution, drugging, sexing.
Yeah.
Poor old those Dominicans, trying to control the uncontrollable. So anyway, entering there, what happened, that deep angst and deep suffering and deep kind of a depression, but I had to walk around uni for a while before I got dentures, smiling at these beautiful young women and everyone else without any teeth. Mm. The dentist said, "Don't worry, I'll have them ready for you in another month." So I had to walk around, and it was absolute torture. Mm. So going to leave, I was doing arts law, and going to classes was absolute torture. So anyway, that was interesting. So halfway through the first year, I became aware next door to me was young Chris Stryker from Adelaide, who was actually gay, was confirmed really in his whole lifestyle. And I wasn't really aware of it, but one day we were downtown, I met Chris down at Civic, down Saturday morning. And this Croatian guy came up and said, if you ever go near my brother again, I'm going to kill you. And I just found myself automatically rushing in and stepping between them. I said, what's going on here? This guy, what's he done to you? You know, and he sort of backed off and went away. So Chris, we walked back to uni together, to college together, and he said, look, I noticed you've been having a fairly quiet time and you've been a bit, you know, this and that. How are you going? And so I said, yeah, I haven't really enjoyed it. He said, look, here's a book by Dr. Ainsley Mears, Relief Without Drugs. See what you think of that. It's helped me and it's helped others. So I read through that and he described an exercise called mental antaraxis. Now, this is the same exercise that he gave to Ian Gawler when Ian Gawler cured his cancer.
I think antaraxis is a Greek word, isn't it? It comes from the philosophers in peace of mind.
Yeah.
That was the goal of the post-Hellenic philosophers.
Very similar to
Buddhism. Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. Well, he travelled around Asia and he sort of developed this technique out of travelling right through India and Nepal and Asia. And it was really yoga. It was yoga nidra that he hit upon, and he found it was just working in all sorts of ways for healing people with all kinds of conditions as a psychiatrist. And so I just was doing it in my room like 24/7. Like, I just thought, this is incredible. I just found I'd lie down on the carpet and sometimes I'd go to sleep, other times I'd... And look, to this day, I've reconnected with a lady who teaches deep rest meditation, Jaya Rashmore. She's an international teacher. She has amazing results. The whole retreat's done lying down for 10 days or 12 or 2 weeks, whatever. She does them through Europe. She's been doing it for years. And the effects she gets from deep rest retreats is absolutely extraordinary.
Mm.
So she finds often people in the sitting position, there's too much efforting going on, too much efforting, so.
Yeah. Well, this seemed like a huge opening, because, I mean, this describing a history of kind of toxic masculinity and homophobia, and like you suddenly come across this really soft and gentle practice.
Look, through my whole teaching career of 24 years, I was in some of the toughest schools probably in Australia, Western Suburbs, Sydney. Some country schools that were incredibly tough, you were just about attacked. And sometimes the whole room was in uproar, people threatening to throw bat. They were dropping suitcases out of windows from the third floor and all sorts of... And you had to, at the end of the day, you'd hang up your bow. And sometimes in the middle of the day, I'd be just doing mental antaraxis. I'd just be... I'd close the door of the classroom, pull the blinds, lie down, and the harder, as Mears said, the harder the surface, the more painful, the better, the deeper the relaxation.
Mm.
So after a while, I sort of developed an ability to within minutes, go into this deep. I'd have a relaxation response, as Dr. Benson later described, happened, and I'd just go into a blissful samadhi, and I'd... One time at Lismore High, I was teaching, and I said, I'd like to do a bit of mental antaraxis. I just had a tough class. Went into the old book room and was in process of doing it, in there about 10, 15 minutes, and our history master, looking for some books, swung the door open. There I was, splayed out on the floor. He said, Peter, are you all right? Have you had a heart attack or something? You know, he totally went into a paroxysm of anxiety. You know, I was just doing some yoga practice. Oh, was that yoga? Oh, okay. he was beside himself. You know? Yeah. So I collapsed while I was trying to get a book from the top shelf. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard, to look back historically and how there wasn't that much yoga around, there wasn't much Buddhism around in those years. It was quite a different culture to what it is now.
Absolutely. And look, it saved my life. Chris Stryker, the little red-headed gay chap from Adelaide, saved my life. So I've got no doubt at all. He saved my life.
Does he know that?
I don't know where he is, what he's doing, you know. He may be married with 10 kids, you know.
It'd be nice to catch up with him one day, maybe, let him know.
Oh, look, it was extraordinary how these things happen, you know. And later on today, I was to meet William Johnston, because I then got into reading Alan Watts, and I did TM meditation, and I used to spend all my spare time in the apartment in the first year when I was playing billiards and snooker. I was over in the Menzies Library looking at all the Eastern teachings, reading Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki. I spent hours, I was failing subjects, also hated law, and I was just, the whole university, my 5 years, was devoted just to studying spiritual literature.
You mean you didn't enjoy contract law? What's wrong with you?
I did it twice. I got a credit the second time only because the scholarship guy said, look, Peter, you've got to make every post a winner from now on. I said, you cannot have any more failures. And I was just sitting there thinking, oh, shit, I better pull my finger out. I'll get kicked out of this monastery, you know, back into the world again. So it was an interesting time. But the Menzies Library was just quiet, you know, you can hear a pin drop. And I was searching and researching, you know, hours and hours and hours. And I'm suddenly thinking, oh, shit, I've got that essay for modern history tomorrow. Oh, shit, I better get back. I'd be eating dark chocolate all night sitting up in my room, you know, furiously writing draft after draft, you know. So it was an interesting life, but monastic.
Mm.
And, I got kicked out of John's for failing one too many subjects and ended up in Garran Hall, which was pretty weird when I look back, because Robert Garran was my partner in Sydney. Her great aunt, her, Robert Garran, wrote the Australian Constitution, was her kind of, through marriage, was became a relative of hers. And I've met all the Garrans, so that was interesting. But we did TM together, we disclosed our mantras together, we had to go back and be rechecked and re-given the mantra again. So
TM was happening at that time. What year was that?
We would have
back
done
to the
that.
Beatles, I guess. And
they'd suddenly made it popular. It would have been 1973.
Yeah.
And look, Yolanda and I went in, and we were virtually living together in Garran Hall.
Can I just say briefly what TM practice was?
Well, TM, you were given a special mantra secretly, and you. Once it was there, you weren't supposed to bring it out again or ever speak about it or share it with anyone. It was a
Who gave you the mantra?
They gave you a mantra.
Who gave you the mantra?
Well, there was a teacher who was, who was assigned to by the Maharishi.
And do you want to explain what a mantra is?
Well, a mantra in this sense had two syllables, the one I was given, and It just seemed to penetrate, percolate down very deeply, underneath all the thoughts, go very deeply. Suddenly you went into what Benson would call the relaxation response. So I was getting
You concentrated on the mantra, synchronised with your breath?
No, didn't have to worry about that. And Maharishi had realised that people were going to make a lot of ego effort, so he just said, let it be effortless. Just allow the mantra to come back in without any effort. So in a way, that preluded what I did later with Master Hogan of effortless effort practice, where Hogan used to say, ego effort's not so good. That's usually when people come to a practice, they come in with ego effort. He said, no, it's not. Ego effort's not so good.
Okay.
And Hogan's teacher in Japan, Master Tonen Roshi, gave a beautiful talk about ego effort one day when I was practicing in the temple in Japan, and when he was falling from a cliff, all he could think was ego effort is no good. So he was held up, he was saved by a branch, hitting a branch, and he had the branch still in the temple. He brought it out after his talk to show us the branch that saved his life.
Well, I mean, now that you've brought up Zen, I'm just sort of curious about how you got from TM to Zen, or was there something in between that?
Well, at ANU one day about my fourth year, there was a sign put up in the Union Refectory Father William Johnston will be visiting and giving a demonstration of Zen Buddhism over in the Asian Studies Department.
He was a Jesuit who had been at
Sapphire University in Tokyo and had been there for many, many years, right. Like a few Jesuits. They seem to be the only ones that penetrate into Japan. He'd come to visit ANU, he was staying at the Jesuit house down near the lodge. Anyway, I went to the lecture and I'd been reading Zen and D.T. Suzuki and came in, everyone was there, and suddenly Father Johnston came on stage with one of these strange black cushions under his arm, put it down and sat on it. And we all thought, oh, he'll start the talk in a minute. Anyway, 5 minutes went, 10 minutes went by. We're all looking around at each other. I cast a glance at old Professor Basham, who was the head of the Asian. He was starting, his jowls were starting to shake. He was looking around, what's going on here? You know, like, we're all looking to him to see what. And Father Johnston just continued to sit quietly on the cushion. It went 15 minutes. And we thought, shit, what? This is not uni. This is not a typical uni lecture, you know. So it was extraordinary. After that, he suddenly broke silence and he started to talk, and it was a very fascinating thing. So I arranged to meet him near the old kiosk near the tennis courts an old wooden building. I met him in there a number of times. We had morning tea and lunch together, and so we formed a sort of friendship. And then I realised he was a world famous author. He wrote a book called Silent Music and all these books, and he was a fascinating guy. We started writing letters, and he was encouraging. So that silence that I observed for the first time was a very powerful introduction reading all this for a number of years Zen. And yeah. There were a couple of Zen beat Zen kind of guys in our. I was down there at a different college then, next to John's at Ursula College, and there were a couple of beat Zen guys there. We were always talking Alan Watts over dinner. But Alan said, Alan said that you don't have a method or a practice. You must remember that. You know, we'd be debating into the night. Yeah. It was a very fascinating time. But suddenly Father Johnston just cut through all that, came in with his cushion and sat down. Yeah.
Well, that's very interesting because, I guess the first wave of Zen in the 50s and early 60s was the Beat Generation. And they really took off with it. Alan Watts' notion that, you're already Buddha anyway, so what's the point in having to practice? Mm. And that was almost the first sort of wave of Zen, was that very kind of undisciplined beat thing. And so Father Johnston was, I guess, one of the first second wavers, the ones that have been trained in Japan.
And
so you developed a teaching relationship with him? Or?
Not really, no, more of a mentor.
Mentor relationship.
An encouragement relationship. And he was a great guy. I couldn't quite get into all his Christian stuff at the time. I've just left that. It took me about 6 months of John's College in the second year to I sat up all night writing. I'd got to journal writing through Karen Horney, who was a great American psychiatrist who'd had a relationship for a long time with Eric Fromm. They were together. And Karen put out a whole thing about journal writing. I started. I couldn't stop, and everything was just coming out through journal writing. It was a powerful meditation.
Well, and that's interesting because Karen Horney and Fromm were the two key psychoanalysts who also got a dialogue going with Zen Buddhism in the middle 60s or something.
Extraordinary. They were so early. So early.
Interesting. I didn't know Karen Horney was into journal writing.
Oh, she put a beautiful book out about psychotherapy and journal writing, how people could just work on themselves. So, they didn't need to have expensive psychoanalysis, they could just do it all through journal writing. So I took it up, I couldn't stop. I had reams of paper, and a friend still got all that. She took it back to Thailand with her, a lady friend of mine at the college, said, I've still got all your. It was all on this green, funny green reject paper, and I was just writing both sides. And in that combustion that happened, I totally, all my doubts about Catholicism and church, all that came out and combusted, and I just one day I got up and thought, shit, I'm out of that. And poor old Father Hegarty stumbled towards me when he didn't see me at Mass. I said, Peter, what's happening? You weren't at Mass today. And I said, no, Father, I'm gone past, I'm out of that.
Right.
In my, you know, naive way.
Yeah.
And he said, how am I going to tell your poor mother? You know, and his mum was communicating with him on by the week almost to see, you know, they'd right. formed some kind of relationship with each other. And so it was a, he said, how can I tell her? What's happened? I said, oh, sorry, it's just happened. And so I felt incredible freedom. I didn't, you know.
Mm.
So there's a hell of a lot of other
So that was kind of like a gradual, but then sudden epiphany?
No, I had to work tremendously hard. You know, it's what I now call in retreats, when people enter a retreat, gathering of the energy. The energy had to be gathered to fever pitch, to combust, to burn off all the dross.
Okay.
It was the bushfire that burnt the dross and allowed the new seed from the eucalypt to sprout. You needed okay. that crisis of combustion. It had to happen.
Okay.
And I later read where Krishnamurti recommended that to some people, just keep writing, let it all come out through. And so writing can be a very, very powerful meditation. Hugely powerful meditation.
But the realization you weren't going to go back to Catholicism, was that kind of like a after the combustion aha moment?
Or oh, it was incredible freedom. I just felt me a thousand years of tradition and so it's what's made me a fair bit of a critic of the Zen tradition too. I mean, I've been more attracted to Tony Packer and Hogan, who I was with for a long time. Gave me my name, Joshu. I've been a sort of a critic now of the accretions of tradition and how they hold people back.
I mean, all those accretions. Well, after you were freed from the Catholicism, at what point did you then embrace the Zen tradition more?
That was gradual. I had that. I was a founding member of the Sydney Zen Centre in 1975, six. My friends Stewie Glanfield and Lee Davison had set it up.
And like many of you know Stewart Glanfield, who comes to our Zen group. Stewart?
Yeah.
Stewart was a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner, but was always frequenting our Zen centre at Linfield. And I was a postman, and I used to deliver their mail and dropped in of evenings. And so I got involved in sitting more and more, but I had to. The Catholic boy in me that had been repressed had to break out, and I joined Rajaneesh. And these Zen people said, "What are you doing, Peter?" I said, "I'm joining Rajaneesh because I wore orange round and beads with Rajaneesh's man. Even in the post office, I came to work, and I for a shy person to do that, Rajaneesh knew what he was doing because I'd gone into another state. When I put all that on, It cut the mind's road. It's what the Koan Mu does. It just cut them. I didn't know if I was Arthur or Martha. The family didn't know if they'd lost me. And so it was 6 months, and then I went off to India, and I met Rajaneesh. I was there 6 months, and I was saved.
Does everybody know who Rajaneesh was?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was saved. One day I was staying at the Rajaneesh Centre in Bombay, and someone had scribbled out, "You must see this person while you're in Bombay," and I was staying over there. And I thought, better take that out of my wallet. I had it scribbled away in the wallet. Bev Clark had given it before I left, because she'd known about it through the Muktananda Ashram near Bombay at Ganesh Puri. And I pulled it out and said, Ketwadi Lane, Ketwadi, Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj. Okay, today I've got nothing to do. Why don't I just jump on a bus, find out where this Ketwadi is, and go and see Maharaj. So I managed to find a dirty little lane in the midst of this massively slum-like suburb, one of the typical sprawling suburbs of Bombay that go on forever. And I wended my way. I said, I came in the bottom door. I said, "Is this the house of Maharaj?" I said, "Yes, yes. Upstairs, go up." So I started to trot upstairs, beads hanging in front of me and all the orange regalia. And anyway, as I got up to the stairs, I saw this figure sitting there looking intently, very intensely at me as I came up the stairs.
What's the, on his own?
On his own. I couldn't see the others in the room. Oh, okay. There was a mass of other people in the room.
Right.
And as soon as he saw me, he just went back. And shit, okay. And so I just kind of went up and sat down, and he looked intent, very intently at me, and he said, he just looked, and he said, who were you, what were you before you were born, and what will you be after you die? I said, sheesh, no one's ever asked me that before. And my mind tried to solve, and I found I was going back through all the files. Shit, what's this answer to this? And suddenly I just gave up, and I went into the most profound sort of silence. I just let go, and I went in, and it was nothing. It was just this huge space. And I just sat there and thought, shit, what's this? And it kind of cornered me. And then I came at it, and he said to me, do you want to be alive and kicking? I said, yeah, I do. He said, sit over there. And he pointed me to the back of the room. And so it was an extraordinary encounter. And I stayed on and on for weeks, and I couldn't believe it. I thought, this guy's for real. He is the real thing, the real McCoy. And one day I came, and he said, What have you got out of Rajaneesh? What have you been getting out of this? And I'd never even looked at that either, and I had to look. I thought, what have I got out of this? I haven't got anything.
Didn't he have lots of sex?
I had some great, wasn't even that great, because it was too self-conscious, you know. I mean, everything in life that's great happens with that thinking mind, you know. So all the therapies, everything, was all too self-conscious by far, and people trying to emote, and when you try to emote, you're not emoting, you know, this is the whole thing. And it's been an amazing time, but you know, I had a great Italian girlfriend for a while. You know, it just was that an amazing experience I can talk about another time. But I suddenly realised, hey, shit, what have I got out of this? When he asked, I thought, no, that's the end of it. I haven't got anything out of this at all. I marched back to Pune, took off my orange, and went down the Mahatma Gandhi Road and bought a whole suit of green as protesting. Went back to Ma Arup and handed my mala back. And I wore green around the ashram for 3 days as a protest, as my silent, my Sufi whatever protest, and then ended up coming back to Maharaj. But something intervened with Maharaj. I couldn't. It was all too true. I thought, this is awakening. I'm not ready for this. And so a friend said, come down to Goa for a little trip. And I went down and had a big trip, because one night I had some acid, some Rajaneesh people were selling some acid on Anjuna Beach. And they were doing their wares, you know, showing their wares there, and I said, might as well.
It was pretty good acid in those days, wasn't it?
Oh, it was on blotting paper, and I was knocked out for 3 days, and I was that shattered. I thought, I had a chance of awakening, full awakening with Maharaj. What have I done? And I was totally shattered. it was a shattering. I stayed up all night, I couldn't sleep. I finally found a guy on Arjuna Beach who befriended me and said, well, geez, man, I met another guy who befriended me, a black guy further down the beach. He said, geez, what you're going through is nothing. He said, we had a wild party here last night and someone threw acid in our drink, was spiked with all these drugs, and well, I'm right up there, yeah. So the whole thing was like that. And but I remember one guy, this guy I met in the middle of the night, he said, I've got to get some firewood for this fire. And he was pulling out a branch of a tree, and I was totally aghast. I thought, he's pulling the arms off that tree. How can he do that? And I must have felt I was the tree, There was no separation. I thought, he's pulling the arms off that tree. And I was in agony. I thought, what's going on here? So anyway, I thought I'd lost my calling to awakening, and I'd shattered everything, pulled the six gun out, shot every toe off my feet. I felt shattered, but that I'd allowed something to interfere with the process that was happening with Maharaj of awakening.
So you never got back to Maharaj?
I went back, but it was different. What did Heraclitus say? You can't step in the same place in the river again. was totally different. I couldn't get back to that halcyon. You know, what do they say? You can walk through a herd of elephants, but when it awakens, you can walk through the first few times, and once the herd of elephants awaken, it makes the whole thing very much different.
So you're talking about a herd of elephants within yourself, you mean?
Yeah. Beginner's mind was there when I entered, and then beginner's mind had been tampered with, and I.
So what happened then? Because you came back to Aussie.
I did. I'd seen so many teachers there. It was a whole story. I met Papaji. I'd met Papaji in Sydney before I went over. I'd met Papaji accidentally at the Wayside Chapel. A friend, Duncan Ellis, had brought Papaji to Sydney. We were about to see a Krishna.
Got some water.
Yeah, good idea. We were about to see a Krishnamurti movie at the Wayside Chapel. And Duncan said, "Here's my friend Punja from India. Peter, I'd like you to meet him," because I knew Duncan. And I said, "Geez, Krishnamurti's really saying it as it is, isn't he?" And he swung around, Papaji swung around and hit me full on in the chest and said, "It's there!" And I went reeling back, and Duncan said, "Don't, you're right. But Papaji was...
Does everybody know who Papaji was? Or no. No, you might have just...
Thanks very much, that's great. So look, I was very lucky in my life. I met all these teachers, and they... things seemed to be happening all over by accident. I was meeting these teachers, and when I was in India after I'd left Rajneesh, I wrote to a friend and I said, "What, do you know where Papaji might be?" And he wrote back and said, "Try down at Ramana Maharshi's ashram down at Arunachala." And I said, "I've just been there and I couldn't see him there." Anyway, I headed all the way back to Bombay. It was like a week later. I'm walking down platform 13, going back to Pune. And I looked down the platform, and there are trillions of people in India. Who coming toward me? Papaji was just walking towards me.
Yeah.
And so I just couldn't believe it. I thought, this in India, the chances of looking for someone. And I went down on my knees to him. I just, "Papaji, can't believe this."
So he was a disciple of Ramana?
He was a disciple of Ramana. So life's amazing. Look, I just think for everyone, every person, when you're kind of into the seeking, you're being met. If you're making an effort, life is actually meeting you all the time.
Mm.
Life's always, if you're involved in the great effort, as we call it in Zen, which is really effortless effort, you are being supported and met all the time by life.
Mm.
It's an extraordinary thing. You don't... Mm. Tangan Roshi, that night when he brought out the branch and said, in the temple, he said, "Truly everyone has their branch. They don't realise it, but everyone's got that support from life."
Well, Ramana and Papaji, the seeking or the searching didn't come to an end with them. Like, so you went on your Zen journey.
Came back. Good question, Andrew, and sorry to be beating around the proverbial bush. It was Aiken Roshi called his path willy-nilly Zen. Well, this is description has been very willy-nilly. But look, I came back because I realised that I hadn't been going that real, taking much responsibility for a practice or going that deeply. You can have an experience, but somehow by adopting a practice, you're taking responsibility. And Aiken Roshi used to tell a lovely story. He said, "Look, if you're trying to find water or oil, particularly water for us because we can't live without it, we're travelling, if we're moving around a paddock and we keep starting a well and digging down, and suddenly we say, 'No, we're going to pull up and go to another spot and start going down,' he said, 'You never ever find water. You've got to stick to a practice for a while and you'll hit pure water." So
not everybody would know who Aiken Roshi is, just quickly.
So Robert Aiken was studied in Japan. He was interned in the war, and then he took up Zen practice. Wrote a book called Taking the Path of Zen, probably his most famous book. But he set up the Diamond Sangha, which is based in Hawaii, but it's now spread around the world, has a lot of centres. And our centre in Sydney is a Diamond Sangha. We became a Diamond Sangha centre. So
you spent some time in Hawaii with...
I spent time in Hawaii with Robert Aiken, and So it was a bit of a spiritual Disneyland, and then I grounded. I realised I needed that grounding.
Okay.
You know, as Chagyan Trungpa said, Vipassana practice, he saw as the first stage of Buddhism, but we're always coming back to it because we need that grounding. We can easily lose it. And what is an awakening? What is a memory? It's just a memory. This moment's all we've really got. And the breath in our practice always, breath is always now, always brings us back to the moment now, it always grounds us now. So I'd always come back to Zen because I really wanted it right now. And I realised what Shodoka calls the Zen doctrine of immediacy. Other paths take lifetimes, Zen is right, we want it now. I thought, I've got to have this now. And so I found myself asking Aitken Roshi about 1980 when I've left Rome. I came back. I said, could I have the koan, take on the koan mu? And he said, yes, I can give you the koan mu. Because I thought, I'm sick of mucking around. But then we read through the koan mu. It just seemed the absolute immediate realization. And he gave it to me, and I couldn't do it for 2 years. It sat underneath. Finally it resurfaced after my time at Dharmananda for 2 years. I was on community. It resurfaced and it was very powerful when it came back because I realised it took away all self-consciousness, because what self-consciousness is thinking mind. Without thinking mind, where you have a dog come in the room, dog's not going to be self-conscious. It's not going to be time-conscious with a watch. Without thinking mind, we're flowing, like we say in Zen, like a fish, like a fool. We're flowing. There's no thinking mind. As soon as Mu came back and I did Mu, I realised what Newman said about it was absolutely true. It cuts the mind's road. And if you cut the mind road, there's no self-consciousness there because there's no thinking mind there.
And a lot of koan practices is about that liberation from self-consciousness, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I found it immediately. When it came back, I found just the intonation of Mu on the out-breath was cutting my mind's road immediately. And I had this amazing thing of I lost self-consciousness, that I used to be so shy and self-conscious, that was all gone. Because the mind, it was the thinking mind that created all that. So the frontal cortex of man is the separation, is the big leaving the garden of oneness. It all came with this evolutionary frontal cortex.
Yeah.
And so people they drink, they drug, they have, they get into sex, they get into everything to get out of thinking mind.
Okay.
That's what Jung said to Bill W. when he founded AA. He said it's all a counterfeit way to get out, to get back to the garden, get out of thinking mind.
Look, we can't cover your whole journey in this 1 hour. I'm just wondering, do you want to bring it to an end? Is it something really important that you wanted to conclude with, or should we open up the Q&A now?
Look, I think even with immediate awakening, you still need ongoing practice. We used to call it sadhana in India, which is spiritual work, because the three, our habit patterns from time immemorial, thousands of lifetimes, greed, hatred and ignorance, the habits are so deep that we need our continual practice.
With your current practice, do you want to quickly share, did you have a kind of Satori Kensho opening in your Mu practice? Or
look, it happened immediately with the dropping of the body and mind idea, like the thinking mind, but later John Tarrant, our teacher, used to read out a lot of koans on retreat. And koan, I think it's 89 from the Blue Cliff record, or 49, the koan that it stuck in my, some of these koans stick like seeds, archetypal seeds in your being, and they come back. And this one, I suddenly saw what it was about, and I had some sort of opening on that. And then soon after that, I opened on everything really, on Mu, and everything became very apparent.
Is it possible to try and put that into words in any way? Or?
Well, suddenly what Dogen says beautifully, to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self completely and be confirmed by the 10,000 things. The idea that I confirm the 10,000 things is delusion, the reality that I am confirmed by the 10,000 things is awakening. So I suddenly realized when I'd forgotten myself, I was you. When I looked at you, I was you. Totally you. There was no me. There was just you. Douglas Hardy called it on having no head.
No head, yeah.
What I looked at, if I looked at the glass, I was the glass. There's no... There's...
And did that sort of, that realization, could you put any duration on the... on the immediacy of that? I mean, was it just for a couple of seconds? Or
when I first had the opening of that case, I sat for 2 hours looking at a silver spoon on my, in Terania Street, Lismore, on my kitchen table. I was fixated. I couldn't take my eyes off the silver spoon. It was glistening in the morning sun. I just sat there, totally transfixed. Felt like an hour or two went past. I was totally... because in the koan it says, the way is dark, dark, dark. And then it says, nothing is better, nothing, nothing, nothing is better than even something good. And then I think it was Uman says, the storehouse, the gate. When I originally heard that, Cohen, I thought, he's talking about the storehouse consciousness, the gateless gate, something like that. But Uman, Uman meant the real storehouse, the real gate, and so Joshua's cypress tree in the garden.
Or the real spoon.
The real spoon, that was, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Yeah. Form is emptiness, yes, but emptiness is also form. So the two coming together. This world is it. I mean, nirvana is samsara.
There's a whole discussion that we can have about how you then integrate those kinds of openings into your everyday life and the importance of practice, but we're not going to have enough time to.
I haven't been able to get away with that practice. I haven't. My habit patterns come back with a vengeance. Greed, hatred, and ignorance abound with a vengeance. I haven't, to be in all honesty. I can't see how I could sustain any kind of awakening without a practice. I cannot. I see people on the net, Advaita people all the time saying, I'm fully awakened. I think, I don't know how they do it. I'm open to that the fact this has happened.
Okay.
But I don't know how you can sustain it as a human being without millions of years of conditionings coming back with a vengeance on you.
Okay, I think that's a really great place to stop. And we...
Thanks, mate. Sorry to waffle around.
No, you didn't. No, that was fantastic. I'll just open it up. We've got time for some questions.
Can I just make a brief comment? What I found very interesting is your description of mantra, and again, your talk about the moon and the koans. Mm. And isn't that the both in a way you
just say
that the power of almost like a nonsense word,
That's right.
And you fully integrate that into your life, your energy, and that's like this permanent background.
Absolutely,
and to me,
absolutely.
The beauty of that is you can go into that practice at any time, anywhere.
Absolutely. It became the great Vajra sword I realised I had at any time, at any place. I could enter that, as Shodaka said, enter the place beyond words, thought and words immediately. So, as Jeff Dawson, our great friend, the friend of Andrew and I, used to say, when I used to, he used to talk about these things, Mu is like a mantra in a way. But the way we practice Mu in Zen has a far more cutting. It really cuts fully the mind's road as you practice it. There's no mind there. You realise the mind's just a phantom. It's a thought. You know, Bodhidharma says to second patriarch, he said, my mind is ill at ease, can you put it to rest? And Bodhidharma says, show me your mind and I'll put it to rest. He goes away and comes back and said, I've looked everywhere for mind, there's nothing that I can call mind. He said, there, I'll put it to rest. There's no mind, there's nothing to put to rest. We're totally at peace already. As long as we see there's no mind. There's no thinking mind.
Yeah. Just wanted to ask everybody here, is it okay to keep the recording going or should I stop the recording now?
No problem.
How does everyone feel? Are you all okay with it? Okay.
Good question though, is it like the mantra? Yes. But the way we practice it has a drive behind it towards immediate realization. Has a very sharp, it's a very sharp mantra. Aiken Roshi used to say, the author of the 13th century Christian esoteric work, The Cloud of Unknowing, talks about the single word of a single syllable has the power to penetrate through to heaven. He said, if there's a fire in your house, the author of the Clouds says, you don't come outside and yell out a lot of sentences. You come out, yeah, fire, or God, or help. A single word of a single syllable has the power to penetrate through. And so it's the word to end all other words. It's the splinter that gets out every other splinter, and then you have to let that go. So it's a upaya of the first order. Upaya in Buddhist sense, skillful means of the first degree. Of the first degree.
Okay. Good. So, any other questions?
Yeah, I've got one. What I hear with your story is from a very early age in your being was this, it's almost like it seems to me, a fire in the belly, this seeking.
Yeah.
This seeking for something
yeah.
that was maybe bigger than yourself, some great questioning.
Yeah.
And I just wonder where that comes from, you know, because one person like yourself will be on this path for virtually their whole life, yeah. and another person will just be in unconsciousness for all their life.
Yeah. It's a brilliant question.
Yeah, but where do you think that came from for you? Was it partly out of this religious sort of fervour and you know, that surrounded your formative years?
Look, I think I was talking a bit about it last night, tangentially, that we're all, I think, we're only very young, humanity is only very young on this. We've only had a few heroes down the track. And us who are on some path now are only good because we stand, as Isaac Newton said, because I stood on the back of giants, I'm somehow good or great, you know, I think we're very lucky, we're incredibly blessed. Bimala Thacker said, those in whom an inquiry is born are very, very blessed. Everyone's blessed. But to suddenly wake up and think, shit, I've been given this human body. I'm not a cow, I'm not an ant, I'm not a mosquito. It's the mystery of having this human birth and realising, you know, the amazing thing of that, and then moving from there. And I think consciousness has played this amazing leela of losing itself in creation. And we're the instrument, the final instrument, after billions of years from a single cell up to now, of consciousness finding consciousness again. And it's the prodigal son returning, it's the widow finding the mite, it's the lost sheep. The joy of that, of the finding. And everyone I feel is on this, is somewhere on this, but unfortunately a lot of humanity just seem to be sleepwalking. Say 99% of humanity.
Yeah.
Are on this sleepwalk, and I can't. It's an extraordinary leela and thing I can't explain. But
wouldn't it be the case, like even the historical Buddha would have said something about, you know, when we're under really difficult survival circumstances, it's very hard to focus on this kind of awakening. If we just, what's our next meal going to be tomorrow? And I think for a lot of the history of humanity, is we've not always had the. I mean, one of the reasons why the historical Buddha founded the community of practitioners or the Sangha was to try and create that opportunity to open to this. And but having said that, like what you said last night, everyone's searching for happiness in a way. Once those basic needs are met, aren't they? It's just that they might not go out to a Zen retreat. They might think the happiness resides in a well-paid job or something else. But they're still on that search in some way.
We're really seeking for the self. And if we develop a love of the self, it's a loss of the self, because we're separate, we've lost ourselves. We're all seeking the self. And I agree with Eckhart Tolle now, who brilliantly said that most people on the planet cannot awaken without suffering. And I would like to add to what Buddha said, life is suffering, but suffering is absolutely necessary for awakening. Mm-hmm. For me, you hear some of my story. It's all about suffering.
Yeah.
You've been caught, and you know.
The great pearl.
Suffering. I'm so grateful that, in a sense, but we cannot awaken without. So if we accept.
I guess that's the thing that I was sort of sensing was that you're almost maybe, because often in our early formative years, we don't have that mature awareness of our life, you know. And so maybe you were in a lot of really unconscious suffering, so much so that this thing inside you just had to break through that.
Gurdjieff has a beautiful aphorism: only conscious suffering makes sense. Unconscious suffering is pretty useless. But when you suddenly say yes, and you enter a path like our path, the great way we call it, when you enter the path, that is the first enlightenment. When you take up a path like this and enter it and be willing to surrender and practice, then it's conscious suffering. Krishnamurti called it the way of suffering. So it's actually conscious suffering. But everyone is unconsciously suffering because they're all separate from their true self.
And I was thinking about that metaphor that's often used in like Rinzai Zen, that the great doubt is necessary for great awakening. But like if we extended that metaphor of doubt to, could be the great depression, like Eckhart Tolle, or the great suffering in some way is required for great breakthrough, I guess.
I think we can.
So maybe I haven't suffered enough.
I think we're all in it. We're all in it together. We're all in it together, and you know, we are. We really are all in it together. We're to take a human birth is an incredible dignity. Gautama Buddha's just one of us. We're equal to Gautama Buddha. He was awakened earlier. Jesus, all the line. We're on a lineage of human awakening. We're now better than, you know, you've got to see your own human birth and see the incredible dignity of being given a human birth. We're equal right along. All our ancestors, our Dharma ancestors, our own ancestors, we're one of a whole lineage. And when you feel that dignity of having a human birth, everything else drops away. I mean, all the shame, all the conditioning that I'm no good, all that stuff that we've been told. You have that sense of dignity of a human birth. And to be born into, to receive a Dharma teachings, another level of gratitude, then to be born in a country like this that is far greater than the aristocracy of old, enjoyed our health care, our money, our leisure, to have time to come to a Dharma gathering like this. It's extraordinary things that none of our ancestors could have. So I think gratitude is a very deep part of our path as well. Always being grateful is a huge Dharma teaching in itself, and helps us along the way, helps us bear the conscious suffering if we're grateful for this incredible chance. I mean, we're Africa, India, you go anywhere in the world, how many countries have got this?
Yeah. It's time, look, one last question before we break for lunch.
Last night you mentioned faith should be more emphasised. Could you just expand on that a little bit?
Look, I think faith builds and faith grows in our path, and I think one of the five hindrances in Theravada Buddhism is doubt, and that is doubt doubt that covers a lot of things: the teachings, the Dharma, the fact of enlightenment. Nisargadatta was asked, what's the most important thing a person can hear? He said that there is awakening, there is enlightenment. That's the most important thing a human being can hear. So if a person hears that, sees it, touches it, feels it, tastes it and realises it's true, automatically Shraddha or faith emerges, great faith. And when we sit in Soto Zen, Dogen Zenji emphasised sitting in great faith, that you already are there, you already are, your true self nature is already full and complete. You're not sitting to get that anymore, you're sitting to express that. Our sitting changes rather than trying to get something.
I mean, that's what I like very much about the Soto tradition and about Dogen, because when you hear people like Nisargadatta or someone saying about, you know, great awakening or great realization, I mean, I'm not the only person that immediately brings about, well, what am I missing? What is it I haven't experienced that I need to experience? And I'm not quite sure if that's a helpful thing.
If I don't mind a question, you mentioned faith, and then you're talking about faith in self or faith in, you know, I mentioned I'm the new guy.
I think faith in what we call big self, in like it's been called that in but really you will never see big self because you are big self. You can never see it as an object. So the faith that I am that is, Nisargadatta said, Tatvamasi, I am that.
How would you describe the difference between faith in Christianity and faith in Buddhism?
Look, I think faith is faith, except that in esoteric Buddhism and in esoteric Christianity, a cloud of unknown, it's an inner realization that you are that. You are that. It's not out there. It's nowhere.
So it's not a faith based upon a belief.
No. It's a sense that you yourself are that. You are that.
Yeah. So it's not faith based upon belief.
It's faith in your own awareness. Mm-hmm. And Nisargadatta said, the only thing you cannot doubt is that you exist. Mm-hmm. You can doubt all the thoughts, all the beliefs, but you can't doubt that you exist. Stay with that. He said, hold on to that like your fingers hold onto an ice cube, and that ice cube will melt, and you'll feel, and you'll find the big awareness, the big self. If you hold on to the sense of I am, it'll start as a small I am, because that's all we know in the beginning. As you hold on to the small I am, it becomes the big I am, the big I am.
Yeah, but the paradox is, this little self, if you want to use the same metaphor, is the big self. It's just that it's the constructions, the reactions, the thoughts, the delusions that get in the way of us seeing that. Like, you know, like you said, the silver spoon, that's it. That is the big self.
Thing is, before people come to the path, they're totally identified. They only know a small self. And when you have that sense of a bigger self, then you know that the big. Then you can know when you're in the little self, you're really in the big self. But before you are totally identified, it's like Gestalt. In the beginning, you're totally identified with figure. There's no background. It's just totally identified in the dream of that. When you have the realization of the much bigger reality, then you can come and go between the two.
That's right. I mean, the little self is focused on me, 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 me. But, yeah.
I like that thing that you said before, that we're not seeking the who we are, but to express who we are. I think that is a really big,
Normally you can't, it's hard for people to do that without some realisation of their true self. When you've had that sense of your true self, it's easy to sit there and not, you know, it's always already here, you don't have to seek it. But until you've had that and you've got it under your belly, you'll tend to always be seeking something in your sitting or any kind of practice. Yeah.
And what follows from that too, and I like, is that our whole life becomes a work of art in that sense, as we're expressing that in our life, how we live our life. Yeah. You hungry?
Thanks, mate.
Okay, we'll stop for lunch.
Thanks for that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. That was good. You done well. You done great.
Thanks, mate. Okay.
From an ex-English teacher.
Yeah, say more.